Sean caught me unprepared. So always be watching. I was halfway down, had to get back up. You sit down and have to get back up. That's a big deal sometimes. I just popped a cough drop in my mouth too. I can't really speak that well with a cough drop in my mouth. I have the same trouble chewing gum and walking. But reminds me of a story. Maybe you've heard it about a preacher one time. He always put a cough drop in his mouth when he started preaching. And by the time it was dissolved and done, it was time to stop. Only one time he went preaching and preaching. He just kept on preaching. Turned out he had put a button in his mouth instead of a cough drop. So we're not going to do that. If you want to open your Bible to Mark chapter 9, we're going to continue our discussion about the narratives of Jesus in his life as he's getting close to the cross. And you might notice here in this particular passage that in the background, kind of like a program on a computer running in the background, you know, in the background of everything that we're reading, keep in mind that Jesus is constantly emphasizing the fact that the scriptures predicted his death and that he must be betrayed and crucified and that he will rise on the third day. That is a continual theme throughout these few chapters that we're looking at right now. You might remember that we just talked about the transfiguration and that following the transfiguration, Jesus said, "Don't tell anybody about this." And there was a discussion about Elijah and a discussion about has he come yet or not? And if Jesus is going to die, then what about Elijah coming? Well, Jesus, of course, was talking figuratively about John the Baptist. We want to begin reading in Mark chapter 9, verse 14, and read through about verse 29, and then we'll come back and take a look at these verses. Verse 14. When they came back to the disciples, that is when those disciples, Peter, James, and John, and Jesus, came back to the disciples down from the mountain, they saw a large crowd around them, that is the other nine disciples, and some scribes were arguing with them. Immediately when the entire crowd saw him, they were amazed and began running up to him to greet him. And he asked, "What are you discussing with them?" And one of the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought you my son, possessed by a spirit which makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it slams him to the ground, and he foams at the mouth and grinds his teeth and stiffens out. I told your disciples to cast it out, but they could not do it." And he answered them and said, "O unbelieving generation, how long will I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him to me." They brought the boy to him. And when he saw him, immediately the spirit threw him into a convulsion. And falling to the ground, he began rolling around and foaming at the mouth. And he asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. And it has often thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." And Jesus said to him, "If you can, all things are possible to him who believes." And immediately the boy cried out. The boy's father cried out and said, "I do believe. Help my unbelief." When Jesus saw a crowd was rapidly gathering, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "You deaf and mute spirit, I command you, come out of him and do not enter him again." After crying out and throwing him into terrible convulsions, it came out. And the boy became so much like a corpse that most of them said, "He's dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and raised him, and he got up. And when he came into the house, his disciples began questioning him privately, "Why could we not drive it out?" And he said to them, "This kind cannot come out by anything but prayer." Okay, let's talk about this a little bit. I think maybe when we look at that overall section, there is a word that stands out to me. It's the word unbelief. Unbelief. And just for a moment to get us started, what group or groups of people, individuals, have demonstrated in this account, in this narrative, that they had unbelief? Unbelief on whose part? Pharisees or scribes here, the scribes, the religious leaders there, they showed unbelief. I mean, they didn't seem at all, they had rejected Christ. They didn't appreciate that he represented something other than what they thought about the Messiah. Any other unbelief in this account? Scribes and the disciples demonstrated unbelief in the fact that they could not raise or could not heal the man of his evil spirit. Anybody else? The father, right? I just said. Pardon me? Yeah. Whose brother? Well, yeah, they would be in another account, not in this one, but yes. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's a very broad thing. We're looking for right in this story. And the father who said, I do believe, help my unbelief. So that word unbelief is seen in several different places in this text. And we want to keep that in mind as we go through here. I might just mention that concerning verse 14, when it says he came back to the disciples, when they came back to the disciples, remember that they were separated? Remember that Jesus took the inner circle, Peter, James, and John, with him up to the mountain for the transfiguration? And so this is happening immediately after that when they came down, when they came back to the disciples. Now this is some of the narratives we've had earlier, this is recorded also in Luke chapter 9 and Matthew chapter 17. So you have three different accounts of it. Sometimes there is information in one account, there's not in others. So Luke mentions that they came down the next day, which means, if I'm figuring this out right, they must have stayed up on the mountain overnight, right? So they came down the next day. And when they came down, what did they find? I wonder what Jesus thought when he came down the mountain. What did he find? What did he come across immediately? There's an argument going on. A big fuss. A big deal. I mean, the crowd was gathering around, maybe because everybody likes a good fight. They're gathering around to watch this thing play out between the scribes and the disciples of Jesus. And so they encounter that the first thing. And you have to think about the fact that here you were up on the mountain and you're coming down. You've seen the Lord transfigured, Moses and Elijah. And even though on the way down you were a little puzzled about a few things, when you came down, you were on a high, so to speak. And you come down into the valley. And this has got to be somewhat of a low for Jesus to see his own disciples acting that way. So, see, the high and the lows of it is something we think about there. It must have been interesting. And I just happen to think that the scribes must have been tickled pink. I mean, it doesn't say it, but they've been looking for excuses to get at Jesus, get at the disciples for any little thing they did. I mean, if they picked grain in the field on the Sabbath day, or if they did anything, they're jumping right all over him. And you can picture Jesus is away, and the disciples are, here they are. They can't heal the demons. Did the disciples ever heal demons? Yeah. The limited commission, Jesus gave them the power to cast out evil spirits. And so they had done it before, but they couldn't do it now. And so the scribes were very interested in that. In fact, the Bible talks about casting out demons even among some of the Jewish people, the Orthodox Jews. Mark 9:38, just a few verses later, says, John said to him, "Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to prevent him because he was not following us." That's an interesting statement, and I'm not sure about all the ifs, ands, and therefores about that, but it's interesting that a few verses earlier, the disciples couldn't do it, and then later, they're saying, "Look, we're seeing somebody doing it in your name, and we need to have him stopped." You know, so somebody else was doing it, but they couldn't do it. Kind of an interesting comparison there. Even Matthew 12:27 says, If I by Beelzebub cast out demons, by whom do your sons cast them out?" Talking to the religious leaders, scribes and Pharisees. So if the scribes were really so interested in the welfare of this man, why didn't they cast out the demon? I mean, not beyond the realm of possibility. Instead, they were just interested in getting at the disciples for not being able to do it. Now look at verse 15. "Immediately, when the entire crowd saw him, they were amazed and began running up to greet him." That's kind of interesting. They saw Jesus. They were amazed. Now, let me ask this question, and there's several possible answers, and I don't know that we can come to a conclusion necessarily, but the question is, why were they amazed? They saw Jesus, and they were amazed. You ever think about that? Timing. I think that's a good answer. Just when things were getting unsettled, it's almost like Jesus has got a sense of showing up at the right time. They're amazed, and they began running to meet him. Here's the answer. You know, we're hearing all this argument going on. Here's the one that's got the answers. Some have suggested other things. Someone suggested that maybe when Jesus came down from the mountain, he still glowed like Moses when he came down from the mountain. That's possible, but not as probable, because Jesus was always private in the things that he did. He performed miracles in private and not calling attention to himself so much. It's one possibility for sure. But and maybe some other reasons you could think of. But if you're busy about your business and suddenly Jesus appeared, you'd be amazed just that he was there. I mean, you wanted to meet him, greet him. And that's what they did. They began running over to meet him. Now, verse 16, interesting. He asked them, "What are you discussing with them?" What are you discussing with them? The question is, who's he talking to? The disciples? Scribes? Who? This particular account in Mark doesn't say. But it's interesting that, I guess it depends on the version you have. In King James, I think it does say he was talking to the scribes. The King James is translated from the Textus Receptus manuscript, but other manuscripts don't have that. So if we take that, then Jesus, my natural thought would be he's talking to the disciples, but he may be talking to the scribes. So if he's talking to the scribes, he's asking someone, "What are you talking about? What are you discussing? In verse 17, "And one of the crowd answered him, 'Teacher, I brought you my son possessed with a spirit which makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it slams him to the ground, and he foams at the mouth and grinds his teeth and stiffens out. I told your disciples to cast it out. They could not do it.'" So Jesus asked the question. Apparently the scribes didn't answer. Apparently the disciples didn't answer. But maybe before all that even happens, the man himself, the boy's father, runs out. It's like, really, when you think about it, what supersedes the argument is the welfare of the father and his son. So he runs out and explains what's going on. So we think about this for a moment. I was going to say Matthew 17 says he came up, fell on his knees, and begged for mercy. So a little bit more going on. He runs up, he does that, and he also describes the boy. I think it's in Luke, in Mark 38, later on, as his only child. This is my son, my only child. And you get a picture that is gradually developing of a very serious situation, a situation that tears at your heart. And Mark is writing this down, and so those who would read it would be affected by it. If you left out all the details, how effective would it be in convincing you about the situation? So he's leaving in some important details in this account. Let's just talk about this boy for a minute. We don't know his name. But how was he affected by the evil spirit? Probably 5 or 6, 7 things here. How did the evil spirit affect him? He was mute. Yes? Is that what you said? He would throw him to the ground. The evil spirits, when you think about them in the Bible, they could affect your body that way. They threw him to the ground. I think mine version says slams him to the ground. This is like, what do you call it, the wrestling show on TV where they, where it's kind of paid, you're kind of fake sometimes, but they slam him to the ground. He is slammed to the ground, but there's nobody slamming him. It's the Holy Spirit slamming. It's the evil spirit slamming him to the ground. What else? Foaming at the mouth. Anything else? Grinding your teeth. Yes, what we have here is things that resemble epilepsy. But it's not epilepsy. It's the symptoms of it, but it's an evil spirit that's causing this. Now, sometimes some of the more modernistic writers will take something Jesus does and explain it away as a disease. Jesus did heal diseases, but he also cast out demons. And so it all washes out in the end. But here he's casting out a demon. And the demon affected him in these ways. Actually, he's called a mute and deaf spirit. So you look at all these things and you think, wow, this boy was going through a lot. A lot of things were happening to him. Let's see. The Greek text, verse 20. Let's see. I'm not sure if this is here or in Luke's account or Matthew's, but the Greek word literally means to be moonstruck. And I can't pronounce it, it's a long word. But it's to be moonstruck. Now, in the ancient world, people believed the moon affected a person's behavior. And some of these effects, like foaming at the mouth, epileptic type of symptoms and all of that, they believe that's caused by the moon, the phases of the moon. And so the Greek language here says moonstruck, but it doesn't mean that the writer is saying that's what happened. He just, the word that he used relates to that. So what we're talking about here is some serious, painful thing. I think it even mentions he couldn't even get any rest, hardly. Very little rest. So your heart goes out to the boy, but also to the father who takes care of him. So Jesus asks a question in verse 19. He says, O unbelieving generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him to me. Now the question that comes to my mind is, again, who is he talking to? Because, you know, sometimes in this passage it's hard to figure out. Maybe he's just talking to everybody. You know, sometimes when Jesus, like in the incident of a little bit earlier where Jesus was talking to the Pharisees, he would say something like that, but he was talking to the Pharisees. Here, you wonder, is he talking to his disciples? Is he talking to the scribes, is he talking to the whole group of people? But in essence, he says, oh, unbelieving generation. Sometimes when the disciples showed little faith, Jesus would rebuke them. Oh, ye of little faith, you know. Kind of like the attitude is, when will you learn? Something like my dad would sometimes scratch his head and say, well, when will you get this? It's a little bit slow to get it. When will you get this? Oh, unbelieving generation. The disciples, maybe. The father, perhaps. The crowd, maybe. The scribes. Could have been any of them. Could be all of them. But Jesus expressed in disappointment over their unbelief. Okay? And then Jesus says, bring him to me. I think that's what it says. Bring him to me. Now, when Jesus says that, is he saying, oh, unbelieving generation, bring him to me? Or is he saying, oh, unbelieving generation, bring him to me? I kind of wish I could hear the tone of his voice. I know that Jesus may have been frustrated. I can't imagine him being out of control, angry, but there may have been just a touch of disappointment or frustration in his voice. So, bring him to me may have just been, okay, we're going to handle this now. And the crowd running to Jesus probably figured out he'd take care of this. And now he's going to begin taking care of this. So Jesus, in verses 21 and 22, asked his father, how long has this been happening to him? Did Jesus already know that question? He probably already knew that, but how long has this been happening to him? And he said, from childhood. And then he adds, he has often thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help him. So why would he ask these kinds of questions? The crowd's benefit. I think so. And the reader of the gospel for their benefit. And you know, the Bible often, when you talk about a particular person who has an illness or some kind of malady and Jesus is about to heal him, the scripture, in painting the narrative, will identify the person and how long they had been sick. Have you ever noticed that? I wrote down a few of them right here on my notes here. It says, in Mark 5:25, remember, it says a woman who had had a hemorrhage for 12 years and goes on to talk about she'd been to all the doctors, spent all her money. And why is that necessary? It's necessary to understand that the detail adds to the sense of veracity, of the truthfulness of the account. It completes the picture. When you're telling lies, you need to be very general. Very general. And nobody can check it out and find out. But when you're telling all these details, any of the which can be checked out, it gives added force to the account. The woman had this disease for 12 years. In Luke 13, there's a woman, it says, there was a woman who for 18 years had had a sickness caused by a spirit, and she was bent double and could not straighten up at all. Whoa, that sounds bad. You know, when you think about the evil spirits and casting out the demons and the spirits in the first century when God allowed that to happen to magnify his glory and so forth, you realize that these people suffered. These people suffered greatly. And then in John 5, verse 5, there was a man who had been ill for 38 years. How long have you been this way? Well, let me see. I just can't remember. You've been sick bad. You probably know how many years you've been sick. You might even know the months and the days. You know all that. 38 years. In John 9, verse 1, they passed by a man who had been blind from birth. And put that in the account. These are not temporary illnesses. I woke up, just happened to wake up one day. I didn't feel very good. Jesus happened to walk by and he healed me. These are things that are checkable, and there are people that knew about it. People had known this lady who'd been bent double for 38 years? Or was that 18 years? Got my numbers wrong. A lot of specific years. And so you're thinking, well, they were just putting on a show. Yeah, she's going to be bent over double for 18 years just to trick people into thinking that Jesus healed her. No, that's not going to wash. So yeah, these things are important. And as Jesus talks to the man, he says, how long has he been this way? From childhood, I don't know how old the boy was, but this was a terrible thing to be happening. And the man proceeded to add some facts to it. Not only all this stuff, but also many times he had tried to kill the young lad. How did he try to kill him? Fire. Throw him into the fire. Throw him into the water. Can you imagine? I can't imagine. So it's beyond my ability. But someone who goes into this kind of epileptic type sort of fit, and there's probably medical terminology for it, and they go into all this, keeping them under control. Can you imagine that? You think about that guy that was named Legion, or they called him Legion because there were so many evil spirits in him, and how they would chain him up and he would break loose and he would run around naked among the tombs, cutting himself and all this, out of control. The demons were in possession of these people in that way. And so here's this man describing this boy, and that would probably indicate that I wrote down this is probably beyond the ordinary. But the more I look into the scriptures, this is not extraordinary. These things were very difficult and hard situations. And the man says, if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. Let's go to the next verse 23. And Jesus said to him, if you can, all things are possible to him who believes. Jesus turns his words back at him. If you can. Jesus saying, if you can. It almost sounds like Jesus is disturbed by his statement. If you can. If you can. What do you mean, if you can? There's no if in this proposition. I can. I can do all things. All things can be done if you believe. And so Jesus is turning it back on him, and he needed to acknowledge that. And as you look at this passage here, the boy's father immediately cries out and says, verse 24, I do believe, help my unbelief. Now that particular phrase, that question, that statement, can't we relate to that? Put yourself in his situation. If you can do anything, it's a little bit of doubt there. A little bit of doubt may be expressed in that. And that little bit of doubt might have been stirred a little bit, made worse by the fact that the disciples could not cast out this demon. And all the arguments going on, making fun of the disciples and all this, it may have caused him to wonder, is it possible? So maybe he's thinking, if you can, like this is his hope. He doesn't know if it's possible, but if you can, take pity on us. Take pity on us and cast this demon out. The word pity is a word that in the King James Version sometimes is translated bowels of mercy. And that always made me kind of think, I don't understand that, bowels, you know. It's a term that had to do with your innermost feelings. Like when you have something that happens and it just affects you so much emotionally that your stomach literally is tied up in knots. Bowels of mercy. And that describes the inner feeling that God has, how he's affected by our situation. Have pity on us. And of course, Jesus demonstrated that he did. But first he said, if you can, if you can. Jesus was often amazed at people's belief. Usually it's people who weren't Jews. The Syrophoenician woman, for example, and others who were not Jewish, but yet they professed a great amount of belief. But Jesus shifts the focus and says, all things are possible to him who believes. Now, we get to the question now, was faith required for this young lad to be healed? And this is kind of a question that people have in the religious world. I mean, when a religious charlatan is a miracle worker, and somebody brings him and he tries to heal him and it doesn't work, and a lot of times it doesn't work, right? And he says, well, you just don't have enough faith. You don't have enough faith for me to heal you. And you realize that, you know, Lazarus was risen from the dead. How much faith did he have when he was dead? None. So sometimes faith was not needed, and often the miracles were done without that. But sometimes there may have been a condition of faith. This might have been one of those occasions here. Rod? Yes, it was a sign. It was a testimony, witness. So, and that's a good point. He had asked, I do believe, help my unbelief. That's a prayer, basically. He's talking to Jesus. He's saying, help my unbelief. How is Jesus going to help his unbelief? He's going to raise up his son. And so, yes, Jesus is responding to his need and raising up his son. If you can do anything, well, how can you look at that situation? I don't know, if he'd been in there for several years or more in this condition, what would it be like for the parents? Just parents today maybe have a child that has some particular handicap or medical situation. They're just on... their nerves are on edge all the time. They're constantly having to watch out and be involved in taking care of that child. It's something that would be very difficult. But Jesus did answer him. He wanted help. Jesus was going to give him help. And so verse number 25, when Jesus saw a crowd was rapidly gathering, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, you deaf and mute spirit, I command you to come out of him and do not enter him again. Jesus throws out the demon. And a statement that he saw a crowd was gathering. I thought the crowd was already there. It makes you think that maybe Jesus pulled him aside like he did so often. Maybe the crowd was there, but maybe others were coming. But, you know, you think the natural course would be if Jesus was there to show off his power for his own benefit, he would have waited till they all got there. They were forming. He might have just said, wait a minute, wait till everybody's here. Everybody ready? Okay, now watch this. That's not the way Jesus operated. And so the crowd was gathering and Jesus went ahead and did the business. Now, if you want to compare this to the way people supposedly cast out demons in the Dark Ages and the ritual and rigmarole that they went through. Watch the movie Exorcist, which I have not watched and don't plan on watching. But you think about all the Catholic rigmarole. You got to do this and this and this, and it's all hocus pocus things. What did Jesus do? He says, I command you, mute and deaf spirit, come out of him. Boom. It was done. The power of Christ's words, victorious over sin, victorious over Satan and his demons. But you know, the demon was not ready to give up without a fight, right? So when Jesus said that, verse 26 says, after crying out and throwing him into terrible convulsions. It came out, and the boy was immediately up and running around. Now, this is such a terrible thing. He had been in convulsions all along, but here he describes terrible convulsions. I don't know what that was like. Amazing, I'm sure, just things happening all over the place. When the demon finally came out, he resembled a corpse. And you know that because the people were saying, he's dead. He's dead. Jesus took him by the hand in the next verse, raised him up, and he got up. The boy was healed in that way. The interesting thing here is he commands him to come out, but what else does he command him? Never come back again. Well, I can't say that, but I've been told growing up, get out of here and don't come back till supper, you know. Something to those effects a number of times, you know. Go out and don't come back till supper. How would you like it to be, go out and never come back again? But suggest something. What does it suggest? What could have happened? He could have come back. And I think it's Luke chapter 7. Jesus talked about that in Matthew 12, rather. When an unclean spirit comes out of a man, it passes through waterless places seeking rest. Think about those swine. Unclean spirit cast out of this man called Legion into the swine. Well, we want to go somewhere. We don't want to just be out here floating around. Send us into those pigs. And the pigs jumped off the cliff and into the water and drowned. But anyway, it passes through the waterless places seeking rest and does not find it. Then it says, I will return to my house from which I came. Ding, ding, ding. There it is. I'll go back to where I came from. And he finds it unoccupied, swept, put in order. And it goes and takes along with it seven other spirits more wicked than itself, and they go in and live there. And the last state of the man has become worse than the first. We apply that to our own lives in some extent. We're not possessed by spirits. But you know, when you give up a habit and you get it out of your life, but you don't fill it with something good, you know, replace it with positive things, it comes back, sometimes worse than it did before. So it's kind of an important idea. Don't come back anymore. Jesus took him by the hand and raised him up. Luke 9 says he gave him back to his father. Luke 9 also says that the crowd was amazed at the greatness of God. Can you imagine that? Well, then what happened in the epilogue, the rest of the story, verses 28 and 29, when he came into the house, his disciples began questioning him privately. You know, how do you think the disciples actually felt about their failure? Just don't talk about it. You know, they weren't going to ask him publicly, were they? But they asked him privately in the house, why couldn't we drive them out? And Jesus said, this kind cannot come out by anything except prayer. Now Matthew's account is a little bit fuller here, and kind of a little rebuke. Disciples came to Jesus privately and said, why could we not drive it out? And he said to them, because of the littleness of your faith. You lacked faith. And he said, for truly I say to you, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you'll say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. Jesus does rebuke them for their smallness of their faith here in this passage. And when he says, this kind cannot come out by anything but prayer, King James there has prayer and fasting. Matthew's account in New American Standard has the same thing in brackets, indicating that it may not have been in the more ancient manuscripts. But prayer and fasting, or prayer, whatever it is, isn't he kind of suggesting that when he says this kind, that there is kind number one, number two, or number three? You pick the door. and that there may be among evil spirits some that are stronger than others, more wicked than others. Are there classes of demons? I don't know. The Bible doesn't talk about it. But there are some indications that for angels, you have some different characteristics or different descriptions of angels that make you think that maybe some are more powerful than others. So it's possible. It's just a matter of curiosity. It doesn't really matter as far as we're concerned. The main point is that Jesus said faith. Faith that this man lacked and needed to have more of. Faith of the disciples who, you know, some have suggested, and we don't know because we'd be just speculating, that they casted out all these demons. This wasn't that long ago in our gospel. We cast out all these demons and we're rejoicing in all that. Would it be possible for someone to begin forgetting about how they did it, the faith required to do it, the power that was behind it, Jesus, and begin thinking in terms of, I can do that. But that's somebody's speculation. They may have forgotten the importance of faith and trusting in Jesus to do that. But regardless of the main thing we go away from here is in learning is we need to put our faith in Christ. In the things that happen in life, let me just say this and we'll close. Sometimes we fail. The disciples failed. That didn't need to be the end of them. They could pick themselves up. I have a book entitled Falling Forward. It's about how that someone like David, writing all these psalms, how David failed. But it didn't mean the end. He failed forward. And people that don't ever fail are probably people who aren't going anywhere, trying anything, risking anything. So yeah, we'll fail. But let's collect ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and get back in the race again. It might be this evening as we think about these thoughts that you might need the prayers of the church. If you need to respond to the invitation of the gospel in any way, we'll invite you to come while we stand and while we sing.